Hey, everybody, it's me, Liz Forkin Bohannon, and I am so excited to be back. To be back hosting the seventh season of the Plucking Up podcast. We have taken a bit of a break from the podcast, and that is because I have taken a bit of a break from a lot of things in my life. For those of you who follow along with me in the real world, if you don't, by the way, follow me on Instagram at Liz Bohannon. I would love to get to know you and to connect with you. But if you follow along, you know that last July, actually, we announced that we were merging the company that I founded, Seiko Designs, with another incredible sustainable fashion brand called Noonday Collection. So that was a year ago last July, and y'all, the kind of world of the merger, acquisition, blending of the cultures and the businesses and the communities, it's a wild world. It is a wild world. It is one of the more challenging things that I've ever done in my career. I also learned more in the last year. I mean, just like, I just feel like hyper growth. I feel like just absolute concentration of learning about people and processes and culture and community and communication and all of the things. But we had folks on the front side of it that were like, you need to expect that this process is going to take about a year. And I remember being like, I do things really fast. I don't think it's going to be a year. And, you know, our two cultures and communities had so much in common, so many shared values and visions, and even down to things like our artisan partners. But they were right. It was about a year. I would say we are celebrating this July. We are celebrating the 1 year anniversary of our merged communities. And it does feel like we're through. We are through that season. And I'm super grateful, oh my gosh, just for everything I've learned, for our communities, for how they rallied, for our partners, and just was so incredible and so humbling to see so many people come together in the name of something that is so much bigger than any of us, and was definitely a reminder to me as an entrepreneur and business person, just the power of purpose, the power of purpose, because when people are a part of something that they believe has a purpose and is making an impact in the world, I believe that their capacity for change and for flexibility and for grit and resilience is so much greater. And I saw that in absolute crystal clear form while leading these communities through this big shift over the last year. So all of that being said, we celebrated our 1 year anniversary, and I celebrated by taking a sabbatical. I haven't ever done that in my adult life, actually. You know, I started Seiko, I moved to East Africa right after I graduated from university, and that's the pace that I've been on for the last like 15 years is pretty nonstop. And so I was really excited about getting to take an intentional space and time away from the day-to-day of my vocation and work and job, and to create more space for my family, for rest, for adventure, and even just kind of for some intellectual and creative space. I am working on creating some new content that I'm releasing this fall, actually at the Global Leadership Summit, and just really wanted some more space for creativity and for research and for writing. And so I had really big plans for this sabbatical. And on the front side of my sabbatical, I got in a really bad car accident. I got in a wreck and I was hurt pretty bad. I mean, I'm here and I'm alive and I'm a month out and I am on the healing road and journey for sure. But it, of course, threw my entire life and definitely my sabbatical turned upside down. And all of a sudden, there was no space for rest, for creativity, for adventure, and all of my energy physically and emotionally went into healing and into hospital visits and doctor visits and follow-up visits and insurance and all of the many things. And so I think have been in a process of grappling with that, of just sitting in the disappointment of that time not being the fulfillment of the hopes and dreams that I had for it. And one of the things that I've thought a lot about over this last season is really the difference between expectations and expectancy. Same root word, obviously. In my life, I find that expectations tend to be very specific and very inflexible. I have an expectation of what this person is going to do or to say, or how this project is going to go, or how I'm going to spend this time, or what this vacation is going to be like, or whatever it is. I have my expectations. And when expectations don't get met, I tend to get frustrated. I get thrown off. I get bummed. I get disappointed. It's not fun. Expectancy is a little bit different. I find that expectancy, you have the same hopes for the future, but it's a little bit more flexible. There's a little bit more room for creative interpretation. I would define expectancy as a deep belief that whatever is happening to me and where I am at, that there is something there for me. There is, if you will, a treasure in the field. It's kind of on me to go, one, believe that it's there, two, to have eyes to see it and ears to hear it, and to go looking for it. I like to call it miracle hunting, if you've ever heard me talk about that concept before, of when I face disappointment or crushed expectations. That to me can be a signal to go miracle hunting and to kind of try to transition from expectations to expectancy, while also, of course, holding a lot of space for just like disappointment. Like, it's okay to feel your feelings and to be disappointed when your expectations aren't met. But I have found that transitioning intentionally into, okay, I'm gonna let go of those expectations and I'm going to become more awake to cultivating a spirit of expectancy in this season. And it has served me really well. And there have actually been several treasures in the field, if you will, several miracles that I went hunting for and was able to find. Maybe I'll share more about those later. But right now, I kind of want to just get back in to plucking up, because part of me being back from my sabbatical means I get to be back here with you, back cultivating conversations of curiosity and kindness and pluckiness. If you're new to this show, we talk about all the things, and specifically things that people don't love talking about. We talk about rejections and mistakes and struggles and wrong turns, because y'all, we have enough people and enough places where we are seeing the highlight reel. We are seeing everybody doing their thing and crushing and slaying and hustling and being successful. And here's the thing, I will never diminish somebody else's success, especially not if she's a woman. But I also want to celebrate the real stories that are always behind what we see as the highlight reel and success. And the real stories are always more fraught with the mistakes, the rejections, the struggles, the challenges. And I want to build a library of stories for you, of conversations that we cultivate, not just about the mistakes, but about like, what did it do to you? And how did it make you feel? And what was the mindset that that mistake kind of spun you into? And then how did you stop the spiral? And how did you reframe that? Because I want to create a space and a library of stories for you as you are going out and you are building a life of purpose and passion and impact. You're gonna mess up and you're gonna face rejection and you're gonna face challenges. And I want you to feel less alone in that. I want you to know that you are in great company. The company, frankly, of some giants who have done amazing things in the world and who are plucking it up along the way, just like you are. And so I want you to feel less alone. And my hope is that there are also some tools and some mentalities and some principles that you can kind of glean from our incredible folks that we interview on this show, so that as you are going through your own mistakes, pluck-ups, challenges, rejections, seasons of struggle, you can pull from some of the wisdom that is shared on this show. And so without further ado, shall we get this season of plucking up going? Let's dive in, because our first guest this season, oh, this was a delight. My guest, Phoebe Robinson. She is a stand-up comedian. She is an actress. She is an author and the host of the popular podcast, Two Dope Queens. She is a bit of a media and entertainment mogul, if you will. But what I love about Phoebe's story is, y'all, she was just so honest and so open and so vulnerable with us about her road to quote unquote making it. Also, can we just pause and talk about the phrase making it? You know, I don't care what industry you're in, there is probably some ambiguous definition that you have of what it means to make it, right? And you see other people in your industry or maybe on a similar path and you're like, oh, they've made it. And you're like, okay, maybe one day if I can do this or I can do that, I will also feel like I've made it. And one of the things that I loved about this conversation with Phoebe is she really shares some incredible wisdom about that phrase, about that concept, about what it means, about what it can do to us, and about how we can take it back, how we can kind of have autonomy over our definition of success and what it means to make it and to really lean into that. And it's super transformational. And also, duh, she's hilarious. So this was a really fun conversation. I will warn you, it is a super salty conversation. There's lots of salty language in this show. So as always, I think a lot of you know what you're getting when you come here, but I'm just saying, if you've got little ears in the car, just know what you're getting into. But without further ado, here's my conversation with Phoebe. Phoebe, thanks so much for being on the show. I'm really excited to personally get to know you a little bit more and definitely for our listeners to get to know you more. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So will you start us off by taking us as far back as you're willing to go in the Phoebe Robinson story and just tell us a little bit about your childhood, about how you grew up, your family of origin, and a little bit about like when you were a kid, what did you think life was going to look like for you as an adult?
Yeah, I am from Cleveland, Ohio. All my family's still there. Grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland. Was very obsessed with movies and TV shows. Okay. I would watch everything from like General Hospital to like, you know, The West Wing, Felicity, Moesha Martin. Like I just really loved TV so much and film as well. Like I used to watch like a lot of movies from the 70s. Like I just was really so excited about that. And I used to write a lot as a kid. I would draw a lot and I stopped drawing. So I think I might want to try and pick that back up. But I have an older brother and I was very much wanted to do whatever he wanted to do. So I used to play with his friends. And I guess the term that you used to describe me back then was like, I was a bit of a tomboy. Like I wasn't particularly like, oh, I want to wear pink and I want to, you know, imagine like my wedding, like whenever women are like, I have, you know, planned out my wedding day since I was a little kid. I'm always like, what? That I just is not, I don't relate to that at all.
Yeah.
Watched a lot of sports. My parents are great. They were on the strict side, which like, you know, now I'm kind of like, yeah, that's probably for the best. Mm. So, you know, like I wasn't like really going to like a lot of like house parties or, you know, sleepovers and stuff like that. So I read a lot.
Okay.
Write a lot of just short stories. So yeah, I feel like I kind of like lived in my head a little bit as a kid. And would like make up these characters or just like imagine like what my life would be like. And I always like imagine myself like on a late night talk show as like a guest.
Yeah. So I feel like you were pretty in line. Like, I feel like as a kid, a lot of times I feel like on this show, when we ask this question, folks are like, I don't know. I was like, they can't see like a direct correlation between who they were as kids and what they ended up going on to be. And I feel like you kind of can't. Like if you're envisioning yourself on a talk show and then landing on talk shows, there's like a pretty – did you have an idea when you were that age of like why you got on the talk show? Or it was just like I somehow appeared, but I know that it involved being on a talk show? Or were you like, I want to be in comedy. I want to be in entertainment. Had you kind of connect? When did those dots kind of start to connect for you?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't like, I want to be in comedy. I would say I started sort of like imagining myself on talk, like late night talk shows as a guest, like maybe once I was like high school age.
Okay.
And I was like, so charming. And I'd be like, whoever was like the, like, you know, hot celeb of the moment that was like who my boyfriend was. So like for a while it was like George Clooney.
Okay.
Or a while it was like Ricky Martin. You know what I mean? Like it was always just, and I'd be like, oh, this is like funny thing we did on vacation. Because I just had watched so much of them. So I kind of like knew the beats of like what a guest would be, even though I never traveled outside of Ohio at that point.
So good.
So I think deep down I wanted to be a performer and be in Hollywood. But I think I was scared to admit it to myself. Like I never really did any plays in middle school and high school. Like I guess I just didn't know like how, like what is the path to like do the things that like I'm obsessed with. So I
what
was
do you
just
think,
sort of.
What do you think kept you from that? Like at that age, as a teenager, from like being in a play, exploring performance more like out there. What do you think kind of kept it in a place where you were like, oh, I'm just going to keep this little dream to myself?
I don't know. I probably just think general insecurity and just like not, you know, sort of knowing what anything is supposed to be. So it's just, it's hard to, like, there are some people who are like, when I turn 18, I'm going to like take my $200 and go to Los Angeles. Like, I just like, didn't even have that thought. Like I just was like, this is all like unknowable, but it's something that I think I want. So yeah, I just was like, okay, I think I'll just be a screenwriter. So that I was like, I can settle on that. I'll be a screenwriter and like, maybe I'll win an Oscar and like, maybe that'll be the path for me. Cause that felt sort of tangible. And also I'm glad I like wasn't acting and stuff when I just think rejection in Hollywood is so brutal and gross and not great that I feel like for a lot of people, if you start doing that too young before you're kind of centered within yourself, I think it just is actually more damaging than it is sort of like teaching you resilience. Like, I just don't know if that's quite the case. I only base this on, you know, people who I've met who have been child actors and blah, blah, blah. And the majority of them, yikes.
I recently
no judgment.
Read I'm Glad My Mom Died. Have you read that memoir?
No, I heard it's amazing though.
Ooh, it's so good. It's really heavy. It's really intense, but it's all about her. Like a lot of it is around her experience as a child actor. And it is plucked up, if you will. So that is interesting of like the rejection in certain like context and to a certain degree can be so formative and helpful. Like I think I have three kids and as a mom, I think often about like, how do I put my kids in situations where they're going to fail, where they're out of their league, where they're going to be rejected. But I think you're right. There's probably some boundaries and that it kind of grows with their capacity to know themselves and to be confident. And yeah, as like a 10-year-old kid, there's probably things that you could hear that would be really challenging to like maintain a healthy sense of self throughout that process.
And the whole thing is sort of like shaping yourself to get someone else's approval. Like it's like, you don't even know who you are yet. So to be trying to do that sort of song and dance for someone else, I don't know. I wouldn't recommend it. But that was just sort of my like, as I was sort of kind of like circling around it. But didn't have the confidence to sort of, I was like wildly insecure. So I just didn't have the confidence to be like, oh, I want to, these are my dreams. And like, this is like what I want to do. Like, I just, you know, wasn't there.
It is interesting that you were insecure and didn't want to share your dreams and also low key imagined yourself being married to George Clooney.
But that's the thing. It's like, none of it makes sense. It's just like all like sort of a mishmash in your head. And you're like, oh, this is. My fantasy is sort of like just regurgitating what I'm seeing on TV and being like, oh, I think I could do that, you know?
Yeah. So tell us about, so you graduate from high school. What's kind of your next step? How are you taking these like ambiguous, I kind of like this, I'm not willing to put it out there. How does that translate into your next kind of step in your journey?
Yeah. So I was a C student in high school, which always just irritated my parents because they were like, we know you can do better than that. And I was just like, I don't really care about any of this stuff. And I wanted to move to New York. Like I just, you know, you see like a lot of movies about New York and whenever Felicity came out, it was like very formative in high school. And I was like, I want to move to New York. I want to get a job at Dean and DeLuca. I want two guys fighting over me. I want to wear, you know, chunky sweaters. Like, I just, chunky knit sweaters. Like, I just was like, that felt like a path that was realistic. And so,
yeah, to mimic my... There's like a whole generation of us that were so formed by Felicity, honestly. Like, I feel that on a spiritual level, especially the need for chunky sweaters.
Yes.
So it comes back to Felicity.
So I was just sort of like, I just felt like, oh, like, I don't know if the suburbs is necessarily my jam. And yeah. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll like try and move to New York. And so I applied to like NYU, Pratt Institute, because I used to watch Inside the Actors Studio like religiously. And I knew Robert Redford went there and studied painting. And I was like, oh, I love him. Like, that could be cool. And then I think I applied to like Columbia and Fordham. I didn't get into NYU. They were like, your grades are hot garbage. And I was like, I know.
I still applied though.
Fully knew I had, was completely unqualified, but I was like, let's give it a shot. I had the confidence of a white man to do that bullshit.
There you go.
And then I got into Pratt and I was like, oh my gosh, it's so exciting. I'm going to be living in Brooklyn. It's just going to be so different than like, you know, what I'm used to. I remember my parents were, Pratt is in Bed-Stuy. This was 2002.
I'm going back, man.
It's 2002. And we were, you know, Bed-Stuy was definitely not as gentrified as it is now. So it was a little bit, my parents were like, what are we about to leave our child into? And I was like, it's going to be okay. And yeah, I just like the first like week I kind of cried a lot. Cause I was like, this is hard. This is weird. Like, I don't have any friends yet. Like, blah, 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 like whatever. And then I just really was like, okay, I'm going to, you know, do the thing that everyone does when you move to New York. You're just like, okay, I'm going to get on the subway, get lost and see how I can get myself back home. And that's how I'm going to learn this city. And, you know, I was a writing major. So okay. I did like, it was like screenwriting, poetry, creative nonfiction, fiction. And I just really made like some friends in my writing major. And that really was so nice and lovely. And then, Pratt had like an informal, improv team. And so I just sort of was like, okay, yeah, I'll just do that. And that, excuse me, that really just sort of kind of like changed my life in a way where it's just like, oh, I'm around other funny people. And I was going to like parties and like fraternizing and like still never had a boyfriend, but I was still like, oh, I'm like in the mix and like just, you know, I'm in Brooklyn and I'm taking the subway to like Soho and Tribeca's like so cool. You know what I mean? Like all these things where I just felt like I was becoming a person.
That's fun. So you graduate with a writer's degree or did I say that right? I don't know. Writing, creative writing.
Yes, that's correct.
And then what was your next step? Because that's like a type of degree, you know, there are obviously some paths that are like a little bit more well-defined. You do this and then you do that and then you get this type of job. And that definitely sits in the camp of like, you graduate and you're like, what's up? Like, what did you, what was your first step outside of that? What was your first job out of college?
Yeah, so graduating and I was like, okay, improv was fun, but now it's time to like be an adult. So I'm like, not going to do that anymore. And I was like, I really wanted to work at a film company. So I applied to like a bunch of places. And in the interim, that summer after I graduated, I worked on the Tom Suozzi campaign when he was running against Elliot Spitzer, LOL. And he got his ass handed to him because Elliot Spitzer was like so popular at the time. Wow. So I did that for a few months and then I would just was like, I like was like going on interviews at different like film companies. I just was like, I don't want to move to LA yet. I was like, I'll do that. But I was like, I feel like I want to be in New York. I interviewed and got a receptionist job at New Line Cinema. And that's how I started out. And I was like, so excited. I got like my Nine West pumps, you know.
Yes, girl. I hope you got them from the outlet. That was my first stop when I got my first job out of college, was to go to the Banana Republic outlet. And I was like, yes, get some pants and some pumps.
Oh my God, you get the pumps, you get like the limited, like all that, like maybe you like dabble in like Charlotte Russe a little bit if you want to feel fancy. And so I was just like, okay, I'm going to be a receptionist. I'm going to work my way up, because I'm very much, my parents are worker bees. My brother's a worker bee. And so it's just very much, you just pay your dues, pull yourself up by your bootstrap, that like American dream stuff. So less than a year after being a receptionist, I got a job in PR department at Picture House, which is an indie division of New Line Cinema.
Okay.
And immediately I was like, oh, I don't want to be in PR. This is so much work. And like, I just don't want to like, like PR is real. Like I love my publicist. She's like one of my closest friends. Like PR is such a hard job, and it's a thankless job, because like literally like no one cares. You're just like, I want this now. And so I was just sort of like, I want to stay at Picture House, and I don't know if this is right. And my boss, Marianne Coltai Levine, was also like, you know what, there's a EA position opening up for the president of Picture House. Like, I think you might like that more than this. Like, it was such a, like, this is, like, never what happens in real life, you know what I mean?
I know, I'm a little bit, like, this has real strong, like, coming of age in New York City, like, movie vibes. That it's, like, I started out as a receptionist, and I was there to work my way up, and then my boss was, like, I see this opportunity for you. I mean, it is very, like, kind of cinematic.
Yeah, it felt really cool, and it's just such a, like, it's one thing that I will say, like, just about, I think sometimes society is just like, you have to know exactly what you want at every single step of the way. And when I interviewed for the PR job, I was just like, oh, this will be cool. I would love to learn about that. Like, I'm sure that'll help me like inform myself and learn about the business as I like write. And then I got into it. I was like, oh, I'm not the bitch that should be doing this. You know what I mean? And I think she didn't take it personally. It was just like, she wants to find the right person for her, and she wanted me to find the right job for myself.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting the job, and I was the second assistant to the president of Picture House, Bob Burney. And it was nice, but I was like, oh, I don't like this either. But it's just like one of those jobs where you're just like working overtime all the time, and you're like not really making that much money. And so you're just kind of like broke, and you're like in a quasi shitty apartment. And I was just like, well, maybe the thing is, I don't want to be in an office. And I was just like, well, this is the only way I can afford to stay in New York. So I stay at the job, and then I'm sorry, this is so long. You can edit this in post. But
because this is really part of the show is really exploring exactly what you said. There's so much pressure. You know, we talk about like finding your passion and blah, 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 blah. And there is so much pressure to do it right the first time, or to know before you've even tried. I think that is such a misconception, that it's like, you'll know yourself and then go do the thing. And I feel like what you're explaining, and even kind of the detail and the ups and downs of it, is such a good example of like, you figure it out by doing it. And you figure out not just what you're good at and what you love and what brings you to life, but part of it is you figure out what doesn't. And even like the specificity of, it took you 3 jobs to get to a place where you're like, maybe I don't want to be in an office. Like, that's just such good information. It's such good information gathering. And I feel like if you don't have examples of that, which I think is kind of what you're providing right now, of like, the stakes can be pretty low. You can go in, you can explore, you can be like really curious, you can pivot, and you can take these little kind of breadcrumbs and pieces of information and then like make it. It's a very experimental way to think about your vocation and your career. And it sounds like at the time, even, which maybe this is a little bit of hindsight, you just didn't put a ton of pressure on yourself to be like, this has to be the thing right off the bat, which I think is really healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I always had a strong work ethic. So I was like, even if I like didn't like a job, I was like, oh, I'm giving 110%. Like, I'm going to be the best assistant. Yeah. I'm going to be the best receptionist. I knew everyone's name. I knew, like, people's, like, favorite lunch plate. Like, I just was very much like, it doesn't matter. Like, like, I know people are like, I want to, like, follow my bliss and be so happy at my job all the time, or I won't do the work. And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? That's not life. Like, you got to show up for yourself. Like, I'm doing a good job at my job for me, because I want to be proud of myself. And I'm not, like, you know, slaving away for, like, my boss. I'm like, I want to, like, get up every morning and know that, like, I'm going to put my best foot forward. And when I go to bed at night, know that I did a good job. So I think that, like, when I was in jobs that I didn't necessarily love, like, when I assisted Bob Burney, like, he was fine. But, like, I just, me knowing I didn't want to be, you know, an executive assistant in an office, I still showed up and did my job. Like, so he never knew that I was like, this is not the jam for me.
Totally. I remember working out way back in the day. Do you remember Jillian? What was her name? Jillian something? It was like
Jillian Michaels?
Yes. Okay, yeah. I did it for 2 weeks because I can't stick to any the workout thing ever. But I remember her having this phrase. This is so weird. It was buried very deep that I'm talking about this out loud. But at, like, during the workout, when she's kind of like yelling at you, I remember her saying, like, you're here. Like, you carved out the 30 minutes to work out. The phrase that she used, she's like, kind of disparaging. I feel like it was like, don't phone it in. You're here. Like, you made the decision to be here, so be kind of fully here. And I'm actually kind of, even though I stopped working out, in other parts of life, I do feel like that impacted me. That it's like, you're here, so be fully here until you're not here. And you'll have more opportunities next if you're just fully here right now. And you go kind of balls to the wall and do the thing. Because people notice that too. And it's just more fulfilling on a personal level to just be like, I'm going to act like I really like this and kind of lean into it versus like, I'm going to, like, you know, just kind of like suffer through it. Because that impacts us, I think, as well. Yeah. You know, like, I feel like this might be a weird analogy, but you ever go out in the cold and it's so, sometimes I do this where I'm like, I'm just assuming it's going to be cold. And so I tense up. I'm like really bracing myself for the cold. And I have this moment where I'm like, you're making this an actually more miserable experience than it needs to be. The coldness isn't going to change whether or not you're like tensing up or just like leaning into it. So just like you're making it more miserable for yourself. So I love it's that. True. That you were just like a eager, I'm here until I'm not here. Okay. So you were the EA and then you were like, maybe not with the office. What was your next step?
So one of my close friends from college, Lindsay Newis, she wanted to take a stand-up class at Caroline's on Broadway. RIP, I cannot believe that place is gone. And she was like, oh, will you take it with me? And I was just like, stand up, like, it's so, like, who cares? It's so lame. Like, I knew, like, of Chris Rock and Margaret Cho and Wanda Sykes, but I was never a big stand-up comedy person. I was like, this isn't even a like, what is that? Is that like a real job? Like, why would anyone do that? And she's like, you don't like your day job that much. Like, this is only 8 weeks. We'll have fun together. And at the end of it, you can like just go back and, you know, write on the side or do whatever you want to do. And I was like, all right, sure, whatever. So this was July 2008. And we went and as a class, we went and saw Daryl Hammond do stand up at Caroline's, and he was so funny. And then our assignment the next week was to like come in with like 5 minutes of written material. And we were like, 5 minutes? That's like so long. Oh my God. We were like, okay. And so Lindsay and I would meet up after work and we would be like, okay, I have this for an idea for a joke. I have this for, and we go back and forth and we're like write together. And then we went to our class. Honestly, like it was literally looks like it was just in like an AA room. You know what I mean? Like it was like, and it looked so janky, just like in a half circle. There are like some donuts there or whatever. And Linda Smith, very funny comedian from Boston. She came up with Dennis Leary and all those guys. She was our teacher and she was super cool, super funny, kind of like, she just like had like an attitude, like you can't fuck with me kind of like energy. Like she was just like a badass. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're all like going around and we have like our little, you know,
We have like our notepads in our hand as we like standing in front of a microphone. And so I get up there and I do like my 5 minutes, you know, you get like a few chuckles. And I was just like, oh, I think this is like what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. Like, truly, it just like rippled through me. I was like, I don't know what this is. I haven't really watched a lot of stand up. Yeah. So
I love that also that sense of this is what I was made for wasn't intrinsically tied to your success at it. You know, you're like, yeah, I got a couple of laughs. I'm in like a church basement with some lemonade and like stale cookies. So it's like, it's cool when these moments, because I think sometimes if you try something and you're really successful at it, it's actually harder to go, well, am I in love with the thing, the art, the craft, the vocation, or am I in love with being successful and like getting those accolades or, you know, whatever comes along with it. So I think there's something really special about stories. And sometimes it can be a gift to us when we're not successful right away, because I think it shows us a more true love that it's like, even if this thing isn't wildly successful or I'm not like great at it out of the gate, even with that, I love it. And I feel like a sense of like life and spark. And I think sometimes that can be almost like a truer indicator of like what we were made for than when we're just like successful right out of the gate.
Absolutely. And I think it was also like this perfect marriage of like you write the jokes, you perform it. So it's like writing and acting, if you will, in a way.
Totally.
And I was like, oh, this is super cool. So me being a workaholic, me being a nerd, this was back when Comedy Central still used to air specials. So they would air half hour specials and 1 hour specials like late at night. So I would DVR them. I sound 82 years old.
You
do. Does anybody know what the fuck I'm talking about? I would DVR them.
Hey, anybody who was influenced to buy a chunky sweater by Felicity knows exactly what you're talking about. So you're not alone. I am with you. I am with
you
in your old age.
DVRs, fucking Dina DeLuca's gone. It's everything I'm describing is a relic. It's. I'm only 38 people, but I would record the specials and then I will watch them in the morning. I either watch the Today Show, because shout out to the Today Show, or I will watch like the comedy specials in the morning before going to work. And it'd be like Janine Garofalo, Jim Gaffigan, Bill Burr, Patrice O'Neill, Chris Rock. Like I just went into like, you know, want to do something, I just become a nerd at it. So I would go do my job. Then I would like go to an open mic. And so anyone who doesn't know, open mic is like, you basically pay $5 to go to like a comedy club at like, I don't know, early evening, like 6 p.m., 6:30. And a bunch of comics, you all sit around and you just pay $5. You get like a free soda. And you get to like just stand on stage and like sort of just like say your jokes aloud. And, you know, the comics aren't listening because they're trying to go over their notes before they go on stage. And so you would do that. Huh. And then you would do bringer shows where you would bring like 10 to 15 people for like 7 minutes of stage time. And literally all your friends are like, I can only do this once because
I have a life. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I have a life. Have you seen Crashing?
Pete Holmes.
I feel like that depiction of being a stand-up comic, I remember watching the episode when he was doing his bringer shows and he's just like literally standing on the street corner trying to get strangers to come to this club. And I just remember being like, that is one of the hardest, most like vulnerable, hustly, like, that if you can do that, I feel like there's not much that you can't do. I just loved like that is a specific road. And not only just because it's like you're standing on a street corner begging strangers to come into this club. I just also think that there is something specifically vulnerable. And I would be interested, because this is your livelihood and your vocation, to hear if you agree with this. I think that saying you're funny and like being like, no, trust me, I'm funny and I'm going to take up space on stage and put myself out there is like a unique type of vulnerability. It feels different than a lot of other character traits, because I think it's so, it's so dependent on other people's opinions. Maybe that's what it is. I also feel like maybe it's even more vulnerable, I think, as a woman to be like, I'm a funny woman. That's vulnerable. And I don't totally know why, but that feels like a scary thing to say out loud and being like, no, I have aspirations of someday actually paying my rent with how funny I am. Trust me, come into this show. Do you feel like that?
I mean, it's completely unhinged. It is so, it's, I always say stand up is a young person's game because you just have to have this level of like non-toxic delusion to be like, you know what I mean? To be like, I am gonna, cause like, you know, I was funny in school. I wasn't a class clown cause I had self-respect. Thank you very much. You know, I know how to be funny, but like reel it in. But it was definitely like, you know, I was at Picture House. I started stand-up class in July 2008. And then in October 2008, we all got laid off. And I was like, this is a sign that I'm just supposed to like follow stand-up. So I would just find these temp jobs or these day jobs. And I would just, I was taking the Staten Island Ferry to do stand up at biker bars. I was doing stand up in front of, you know, people who didn't speak English. And of course, my parents are thinking I'm like, you know, doing sold out rooms. And I was like, nobody knows who I am. Not nearly a room is sold out when I step in it. But thank you for your belief. But I, you know, I really had sort of that drive, not only because I loved it, but also I started stand up when I was 23 going on 24, which is kind of on the later side. Like usually you start when you're a teenager or like maybe in college. Wow. So I definitely felt like I had to play catch up. Yeah. But yeah, it is like one of those things where you're just like, I loved it so much. Like I love just like, when I was very broke, I would like go to Caroline's and they would like let kind of like, you know, budding comics like sit in the back. You just like buy like, I don't know, French fries or something. You could watch a show. And I was sitting in the back and I remember watching Patrice O'Neill, RIP. And I was like, he is just so funny. And I would love to be that funny one day. And I met him and he like kind of roasted me a little bit and it was like so cool, like in like a nice like comic to comic way. And I was just like, this is just like the coolest job to like watch him just sort of like play the audience like a marionette and like they're just laughing when he wants them to laugh. And it just was like, it feels like pure magic. Because it is weird to be like, you don't know me, I don't know you, but I have a bunch of things that I'm going to say that are really funny that you are going to get on board with and you're going to love them too. So it is a very, it's a very weird job that, because so much of it is involved with the audience, like, it's not like I don't play music, but I feel like with a musician, like you can write a song and, yeah, the song's done. You write the song, you play it for yourself, you listen to this, okay. But like if you tell a joke, you need someone else to laugh at it.
Yeah, it's like there, it requires other people to complete the creative cycle. Totally.
Yeah. So I think for me, it's why I say it's very complicated is because you can see some comics who they can see the audience approval taking them in one way. Like there are comics that I know where I'm like, you're better than the material that you write. But the material that you write relates to a lot of people. So that's why you do it. And I fully understand that. And I just was very, I very much like was like, once I get to like a Patrice O'Neill level or a Chris Rock level one day, like I don't want to... I want to write things that feel honest and funny to me rather than chase a moving target of like trying to figure out what's going to make someone else laugh because you don't fucking know. Yeah. And what if you get in the room where they're not feeling you and you spend all this time developing material that you don't even fucking believe in? So I just was very much like, I don't want to fall into that trap of just not every laugh is a good laugh.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. That's good. It takes a lot. And then at the end of the day, it's like, I feel like, especially in anything in life, I feel like stand up is honestly probably such a good like analogy for life, but it's just so acute that it's like, you don't know what the success level is going to be, but at least at the end of the day, if you're creating something that you believe has integrity and honesty and is smart and funny and true to you, there is a level of like peace that you can have even when it bombs. Bombing when you created something just for somebody else is probably like depths of despair where you're like, one, I don't even believe in this. This isn't true to me. And then two, the people that I thought would enjoy it or accept me or give me accolades didn't even. And now what? I don't have anything, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay. So was there a moment, tell us about like, so you're like just hustling, you're, you know, like taking the subway, playing at biker bars, like paying your own way, all these things. Will you tell us about maybe not even your first big break? I feel like that's the classic question is, what is your first big break? Will you tell us about what you thought was going to be your first big break? Because one of the things that I found with successful people is that it is like, I think we have this movie type-esque thing that it's like, oh, and then I did this thing and it was the silver bullet. And then from then on out, it was just really successful and easy. But like, was there a moment in your story where you were like, oh my gosh, this is a big freaking deal and you did it. But then you were like, it actually wasn't that big of a deal.
Well, can I actually tell you something that I was so obsessed with that I never got?
Yeah, tell us.
And it was so upsetting. And then now I'm like, I don't even fucking need it. But there's this comedy festival called Montreal Just for Laughs. Okay. And they would have like a New Faces. They had like a New Faces unrepped and then New Faces repped, like if you have an agent or a manager unrepped, if it's just like you don't have anybody on your side. And you put together your every year, it takes place in July. So you, I guess like in the spring, everyone put together the like 5 minutes or whatever. And you would audition. And I auditioned, I want to say, 4 or 5 years in a row. Never got it.
Wow.
And this is back with my former manager the last time. This had to be 2015. Yeah, I was very broke in 2015. Yes, I was. Yes, 2015. I was so broke. I wrote on this shitty talk show on Fuse that no one watched. And I had my best friend's bachelorette party and I maxed out my credit card to fly to Vegas. And I told her, I was like, I don't have any money. Maybe I can't come. And she was like, it's okay. Like, I'll cover your dinner. I just like want you there. Girl, I was such a bad state financially. And I was also at the point where I was like, I started 2008, 2015. I have a little bit of money, but now I don't have that much. Like, this just fucking sucks.
Cause you're at this point, you're 7 years in. So you're it's like, ridiculous. Listen, it's not like you just went out and 30 seconds later was like, this is hard. You've been at it for 7 years and you haven't had commercial success, at least by this point, enough to even pay for your dinner in Vegas.
Correct. And you're just sort of going like, if this was any other industry, like I was taking, like I would go on boltbus.com.
Oh yeah.
Again, I am 93 years old, but I was.
Bolt Bus does the dollar. I think they still exist. Yeah. They don't do the dollar fare anymore. That was the glory days.
And I would look for the $1 bus to Boston. Yeah. And I would stay on a comics couch, do stand up, and take the $1 bus back. And I was just like, if this were any other industry, if you were a chef for 7 years and you like can't pay your bills making holiday sauce, everyone would be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, it's so crazy. So I was just like, okay, this, you know what? I'm going to stick with it. I feel really sort of. It's kicking me down. And then so they told my manager at the time, JFL, Just for Laughs, they told her that they just don't think I have what it takes to make it in comedy.
Wow.
Gutsy.
Like, not just like, hey, not this year, not this show, not this space, but literally, here is our professional evaluation on her existence in this industry.
Yeah.
And then your manager passed that feedback along to you.
That's why she's my former manager, among other things. You know what I mean? I'm like, bitch, you don't have to tell me that. You could have kept that to yourself. What are you doing?
Wow. That is like, so, okay, will you take us back? Right. I mean, I hate to make you relive this, but I'm going to ask you to. It's for the good of the children, okay? But take us back to that moment where your manager is like, literally, this authority in our industry has deemed you as not good enough. What did you, how did that feel? Where were you? What did that, like, what emotions did it bring up in you? How did you react?
It was just frustrating because at that time it was like, just for laughs, you wanted a late night set, ideally David Letterman. I never got a chance to do that. But there were like these in Comedy Central half hour. Like these are like, honestly, just like the three big markers of like, mm-hmm. you're making this next step in your mm-hmm. career. And I was just, you know, I was like auditioning for stuff, doing like voiceover auditions, doing some acting auditions. And it was just like so much no, no, no. And then you get a yes somewhere and then no, no, no. And another couple of yeses. And I just wasn't at a place where I was just like, you know, this is really frustrating. I am not going to let some like dusty ass white dude decide that I don't belong in all of comedy. Like it just felt like, no one can say that. Yeah, no totally. One can say you're not fit for an industry, but it's ridiculous. So I just was kind of like, you know that the ESPN docuseries, The Last Dance with Michael Jordan and uh-huh. like, you know, anytime like someone would like, he felt slighted, he'd just be like, okay, mm-hmm. all right, great. Now I have a target. I'm going to show you. I'm going to focus all my energy on you and I'm going to humiliate you. And so for me, I was just, and I'm going to come out on top. So I was just very much like, okay, I will never, ever, ever audition for them ever the fuck again.
Wow.
And so the following year, 2016, my first book was coming out, You Can't Touch My Hair. And Jessica Williams and I had sold, like we were doing Tito Queen. So Tito Queens was like a very popular podcast. And I think early 2017, while I was shooting a movie, we sold, or it's either 2016, we sold, Two Dope Queens to HBO. Or maybe it's 2017, whatever. It's one of those years. And my former manager at the time was like, I think this will be a good time for us to like revisit Just for Laughs. Like maybe we could like set up like a lunch or a dinner with them and you could schmooze them and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't need them anymore. Mm-hmm. And I never did. She's like, but this would be a great feather in your cap. And I was like, I'm not begging people who just told me I'm garbage to give me a chance. And I was like, that is, I think that has been a through line in my career where I'm just like, I think where I am now, certainly I'm not in the business of proving myself anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm done. Like, I know I have the skills to do what I can do. You either like it or you don't, but I'm not begging you.
Yeah.
If you don't get it, you'll get it later and you'll come back to me. And I won't have time for you because I'll be busy. And that is okay. That's where that relationship will be. But I was like, I'm not going to sit here and beg these guys to be like, give me a chance to do 5 minutes. By the way, if you're unrepped, they don't fly you out. They don't put you up. I'm like, this is disgusting. This is a thing that we were all chasing because we were hungry or desperate and you want to get that big break. And I'm like, they don't even know how to treat, you know, the talent they have when they show up there. And I'm just like, no, I don't want to do this. So for me, having someone being like, you'll never make it. And then I was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to fill my toolkit with a bunch of different skill sets. I'm going to lean into my voice. I'm going to lean into what I think is funny. And then I'm going to make it in spite of this closed door, I think was very exciting. Did it need to take 9-10 years? No, it would have been nice if we had got there at 5. But I think it just gave me that notion that, like, you be your first yes. They're not the first yes. You are good. Your first yes.
That's so good. It's so interesting, too, because there is so much nuance there of when that shift happened for you, because it's like those, or even maybe that it was what they said versus, like, because you spent 7 years not having an ego and being like, I'll show up at the biker bar at this, like, I'll do great at my job as an executive assistant, even if it's not like where I want to be. So you have this like real spirit of like, if I'm in a place, I'm going to show up, I'm going to take the opportunity. But that it was almost just like you were like, but the moment someone crosses over, and because there's a difference, I think, between being like, no, we don't have time for you on stage tonight, or you auditioned and you didn't make it and someone else did. That, and then like being told, being like, there's like just such a pretentious presumptuousness to somebody naming you as like fundamentally unworthy of a opportunity, of an industry, whatever, that it's like, it feels like when you were told no, just no, you were like, okay, it's fine, I'll keep going, but when I get a yes, I'll take it. But then when someone crossed over and was like, I am the authority that can tell you to just like go home and give up, that's when you were just like, oh, hell no. Like, I'm gonna, and it like created like a focus in you to like make your own path.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like a lot of industries, comedy is so youth obsessed. And so there's such a notion that like, If you're 23, you're not on SNL, like your career is not going to happen. And now that I'm older, for sure, I'm just kind of like, the rule of thumb is that it almost usually doesn't happen when you're young.
Yeah.
That's actually the reality. Like Ali Wong is in her 40s. Nate Bargatze is this stand-up comic who's brilliant and just was out doing the work. And now he's selling out arenas. He's in his 40s. Tiffany Haddish was in her 40s when she was discovered. Pedro Pascal was 40 fucking 8 before he became legitimately famous. Yeah. And so this notion that like, if you don't do it by the time you're 30, Forbes 30 out of 30, these, you know, comics to watch lists, all these lists, I was rarely ever on a list. Rarely ever on a list. And that's okay. But just sort of this kind of like insanity that we instill in people that like, if you don't have major success by 30, 35, you might as well hang it up. And I'm like, life is long. Life is short, but it's also very long. Yeah. And I feel like where I'm at now in my career, like I had to go through all those ups and downs and those yeses and those no's so I could figure out my voice, figure out my skill set, learn how to be a producer, an actor, a writer, all these things. Like you can't. I mean, this is not anything new, but I'm just like, experience is so underrated.
Yep.
To a degree that like, I've seen it when, you know, the festivals, they tap the person who's 22 and you cut to 10 years later. It was too soon. It was too soon. And we don't give people space to develop. We don't give people space to fail. We don't give people space to experiment. And that's a thing that I'm like, even like with, I remember Jordan Peele when like Nope came out, people were like, well, Nope is like not as good as Get Out. And I was like, he's beyond Get Out. That is it. He's got to experiment. He's got to try different things. And so I think the industry and just like life at large sort of like scaring people away from experimenting, wherein like that's usually where the cool shit happens that informs your next sort of moves. I'm always just like, what a huge mistake to do that to people.
It's such a mistake. And it's created a culture where I feel like everyone's walking around with this like kind of panicked sense that they missed the boat and that it's like not of it. And it's like, and I even feel that way. I feel that way. It's just like that I'm old. I'm old and I'm like, if I don't figure it out in the next year or two. And then when you like really stop and look at like the longevity, I have a business partner now and she's like 10 years older than me. And it's actually been really, really good for my, we were talking about it on this most recent trip. We were just traveling in Peru together and we were like laying in bed and I was like, you know, so she's 10 years older than me. So she's like 48-ish. And I'm like, you still have like my whole career, because I had started this company when I was 22. So I did fall into the more like I did the thing right out of the gate when I was super young.
Yeah.
And that can also contribute to the like, yes, like it has to be done in a certain time frame. And I was like, you have more time to your kind of like retirement age, which is like still even probably not, you know, when she's going to stop working, is more time than the entire time that I had been building my whole adult life. And just these like moments of perspective, I just think are like so helpful. And I will never get sick of hearing the stories about the people that were at it for 15 years and then finally got successful. That's so much more inspiring to me than the joker who just like happened to get lucky at 19, you know? I have a friend, her name's Jennifer Fulweiler, and she's a comedian. She is a mom of six. She's Catholic. She's a mom of six. And she has recently launched her stand-up career in like this season of life. She legitimately has six children at home. And she is like on the road doing shows. I just saw her in Portland. And I am like, yes. Like, I want to see the mom of six who, you know, who is like lived life, like her perspective. It's so funny and it's so interesting because it's like, you're not a 19-year-old that just like stumbled into a scene. And I'm with you. Like, I want to hear those stories. I want it to be more celebrated. Ah, so good. You just got me really fired up. Sorry.
No, but it's true. Cause I also think the older you get, the more experience you have, you're just kind of, your confidence just like kind of is unwavering at a certain point. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm now like, I used to, full disclosure, I used to dread doing stand up. Literally would have a pit in my stomach before every single show. I used to just be like, oh, I kind of hate doing this, blah, 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 blah. Excuse me. And then when my show, Everything's Trash, when it got canceled last year, 2022, and I was just like, okay, I put like 3 years into this show and like, I loved it and I love the writers, I love the actors, we all hang out and we still like text and blah, blah, blah. But I was just like, I put all this energy into this show and then it was just unceremoniously just like sort of like dumped, and it was just not the right network. There are a multitude of reasons. I was just like, no, this matters. So I might as well just do exactly what it is that I want to do. And like, I'm in such a place with stand-up. A, this is the most fun I've ever had doing stand-up.
Oh, I love that.
I always want to like do a good job, but I'm just sort of like, I know I'm funny. It's going to be fine. Even if I don't have a great show, it doesn't define me.
Yes.
The great shows don't define me just the way that the worst shows don't define me. So I'm in such a place where I'm just really comfortable and I'm having fun and it's joyful. I think the audience can sense that I'm enjoying myself. And I don't think that this sort of like inner confidence, I don't want to speak in absolutes, but I think it's really almost impossible to have this kind of level of confidence when you're 25.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of it is based on the experience and it's based on the failures and it's based on those moments where you like really crush it and you figure out your voice and have everything nailed and locked in. And so I feel like even though this has been such a long journey and I didn't, you know, Two Dope Queens HBO came out, first season I think was 2018. So we're talking like 10 years before I really like broke out. But I think not only as a comedian did I have to get to a certain place, but also as a person, I had to get to a certain place. Like I had to be more confident. If I was like wildly insecure and had Zendaya level success when I was 24, oh my God, like I would be a mess. I would not know myself at all.
Totally.
And so it's like knowing myself, liking myself, loving myself, being comfortable with myself. All those things inform my career, and my career has also informed my self-esteem. So now that I'm at a place where just like, I feel good and I'm not having this death grip on everything, like this show has to go right or I'm not funny. What?
Totally.
Yeah.
And that energy when you're receiving someone's craft or art is so Like, you can sense that. There's something so beautiful about when you are on the receiving end of somebody who's like, I don't need you. Like, I don't need you to love me. I'm doing this because I believe in it. That creates an energy that is so good and so rich and so valuable that it is actually, I think, also a gift to other people. Like, when you do that level and get to that place where you're like, there's some separation between the creator and what you create and then how the thing is received. But they're all kind of these separate different entities that, of course, like, relate to each other, but they're not all intrinsically tied to one another. I actually think the gift that you're able to give people in that is even greater. And I love that. I love that so much. And I'm so glad you're in this season. And I'm really, really glad. Like, it may sound like so cheesy, but it's just like, I'm so glad you kept going, you know, where it's like, I'm so glad that you kept going and that now, you know, not that there aren't still different challenges or disappointments or things ahead of you, like, life is life. And if you keep growing and evolving, you'll probably keep taking risks and actually kind of doing that mini cycle over and over again. But I just feel like this sense of gratitude, it would be so easy to give up. It would have been so easy for you to hear those comedy festival guys and just go like, whoa, they see something that I can't. This is embarrassing. It would be humiliating to get this like feedback and then to keep showing up. They know more than I do. They are more of an authority. And I just feel so grateful that you kept going and kept creating and that we get to benefit from your work in the world. So thanks for being
plucky. Thank you. I mean, you know, there are definitely moments where I wanted to quit. Like, just to be clear, like, I don't want anyone thinking I just am rock solid. But I just was sort of like, I don't know. I was just like, I look at Seinfeld. Like, he's successful because he was just very much him. Wanda Sykes is successful. She's just very much her. So I'm like, if I just try to be myself as much as possible and I just stick it out, there's so much that is truly about perseverance.
Totally. I completely agree.
And about like, okay, by sticking out, does it mean that I am going to be the next Chris Rock? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But can I have a career? Can I have fun? Can I have a life that I can build for myself? Like, I bought this apartment and like, I, you know, I'm able to spend time with my friends and family and everything. If I can like have the life that I want, that's great. I can't control the fame part. Yes. I can't necessarily control being like, you know, a gajillionaire. I can't control any of that. But can I control this career being so fulfilling and enriching and just be open to like things that like come my way, like, you know, interviewing Michelle Obama on her book tour. I could not have predicted that. You know what I mean? Like, becoming friends with Bono, could not have predicted that. You know what I mean? And so it's like every time I like didn't get cast on a show or like a show I created got canceled or something like that. Of course, I felt down. I kind of had to lick my wounds for a couple of days or a couple of weeks. But I'm always like, in the end, it kind of just like evens out. You know, like when you like hang out with like one of your close friends, you're like, oh, I got this brunch. You'll get the next one. In the end, we'll have all spent the same amount of money. I feel like in the end, the amount of wins and losses will probably be even, and that's okay.
Oh, that is such a good analogy. Just like the peace, the freedom, the open-handedness to believe that in the end, like, it's going to net out and probably net positive, and to release some of those, like, the micro moment, the micro opportunity, the micro thing, and to not let you define that or to not be defined by that. Oh, that's so good. That's so good. Okay, well, I could keep talking to you for forever and ever. I genuinely feel very like, I just got to go out and keep going. And like, I feel very inspired and very energized. So thank you for sharing not just the highlights and the wins, because there have been a lot in your career, but those kind of behind the scenes moments where you kept showing up and kept at it and kept pursuing your own kind of authentic, true to yourself way of creating and existing, because we all get to benefit from it. And so I'm glad you kept going.
Oh, thank you so much. This was so fun. I feel like I just was like, blah, 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 but
it was great. This was one of my favorite interviews I've done in a long time. So thank you. Thank you so much. Again, I'm like genuinely like, okay, hopefully people listen to this, but I'm just going to listen to the raw. I'm just going to listen to the raw episode next time I'm feeling really down in the dumps. I have the benefit of all the video, so I could actually just pretend that we're rehabbing this conversation and next time I'm in a dark moment. So I personally and selfishly thank you for your service.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Plucking Up Podcast. For updates and announcements about the show, you can visit lizbohannon.co or you can follow me on Instagram. I'm at lizbohannon and I love hearing from my pluckies. So you know the drill. Until next week, stay plucky.